We all know about racism, but what about speechism?
For any one person or any one interaction, it's always really hard to know if a bias occurred, right? You know, was this discriminatory? Was this someone didn't like this one individual having nothing to do with their social category? But there's lots of evidence showing that discrimination does occur at a group level. You know, you could have a bunch of participants interact with people and say they're interacting with someone who's speaking in a way that people consider to be standard versus speaking in a way that people consider to be non-standard or to be foreign. And then you find that people are treated really differently.
That's Catherine Kinsler. We talk with her about her book, How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You. Then we remember anthropologist and anarchist activist David Graeber. We play excerpts from our 2011 interview with him about his book, Debt. He died September 2nd. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Race, class, and gender shape our social identities and thus who we perceive as like us or not like us. But one overlooked factor can be even more powerful: the way we speak. As psychologist Catherine Kinsler reveals in her book, How You Say It, the way we talk is central to our social identity. We can change how we speak to some extent, but for the most part, we're forever marked by our native tongue and are hardwired to prejudge others by theirs, often with serious consequences. Your accent alone can determine the economic opportunity or discrimination you encounter in life. Our linguistic differences present challenges, Kinsler shows, but they can also be a force for good. Humans can benefit from being exposed to multiple languages, a paradox that should inspire us to master this ancient source of tribalism and rethink the role that speech plays in our society. Catherine Kinsler is professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, where she leads the Development of Social Cognition Laboratory. Well, Catherine Kinsler, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in this book, How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You, it's focused on how language and how we talk our languages, our accents, construct our social reality. And before we get into the meat of the book, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this whole topic, because it's something I get the impression you've been working on it for a long time in your research.
Yeah, I have been working on it for a while. I began thinking about this topic right before I went to graduate school. It was the summer of 2003, and I spent the summer in Croatia and traveling around the Balkans, Serbia and Bosnia. And, you know, I was taking a language class, and I had a textbook with me that I'd purchased in the U.S., and it was called Introduction to Serbo-Croatian. And when I got there, I was told by a lot of people that, you know, people didn't call the language that. They called it Serbian or Croatian or Bosnian. And, of course, this was a really naive observation on my part, but as nations are diversifying and changing and separating, their languages changed too. So, you know, this was in the decade following civil war and the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. And so with social change, people see language change. And that's just, you know, that's true all over the world and throughout time. And so then when I went to graduate school in psychology, I became interested in somewhat of the flip side of this, which is to say, do young children start to see language as reflecting social groups? So babies don't know anything about nation states and civil wars, but they may start to think something about social groups and who's like them and who's not like them. And so we were interested in how early in life children start to see language as providing social meaning.
And how early is that?
Well, some of my research finds that really beginning early in life, within the first year of life, babies start to prefer people who speak in a familiar accent of their of a familiar language, of the language that they hear around them. And they also start to construct some meaning from language. Now, it's, you know, of course, they're learning language. They're constructing meaning in that sense, but they're also constructing some social meaning. So they're starting to think that two people who speak in the same language might be alike each other in some other kind of meaningful way.
You say that language defines in-group and out-group. You know, that's pretty obvious from your example. You know, the Serbians called it Serbian, the Bosnians called it Bosnian, the Croatians called it Croatian. You know, they were differentiating themselves. And in terms of babies, you say that, you know, babies are much more focused on differentiation of in-group and out-group with language than they are with race. So deconstruct that for us.
So babies are starting to, you know, learn lots about their social worlds. And so they're learning about the people that are around them and the languages that are around them. You know, they're like little sponges picking up on what's happening around them. Now, babies do start to detect differences in skin color, and also they become better at differentiating faces that they're familiar with. But I think that this early thinking about race that starts in infancy, I don't think it's the same as later racist attitudes that emerge in older children and adults that are a reflection of living in a society that is racist at many different structures and levels of society. So for babies, you know, I find in some of my studies, as do others, that they start to see language as having this kind of immediate social impact in terms of thinking about who would you want to affiliate with, who would you want to learn from. And I don't think that babies are thinking about skin color in that same way early in life.
I was really struck by how you did experiments with babies. And when people who spoke the same language spoke with each other, the babies, you know, kind of assumed, well, that's right. And when people who spoke the same language agreed with each other, the babies were fine with that. When they disagreed, they were disconcerted. And the opposite is true. They were kind of disconcerted when people who spoke with different accents agreed with each other versus not agreed with each other. Explain that experiment and, you know, what that means. What's the import of that?
So we use looking time as one measure of what babies are thinking and understanding and what kinds of information they're processing. And so what we know, one method that's in my field is to show a baby a series of events. And if they see the same thing again and again, they often start to get a little bored and they don't look as much. And then if they see something that's new or different or surprising in some way, they look again. And so I think you see this in adults looking times too, if you, you know, kind of stare at something that's not what you were expecting. And so you can think about that and how infants react. And so, for instance, if we show babies to people who speak in the same language, and then subsequently they're nice to each other, they seem like they're friends, babies looking doesn't seem to, they don't look that long at the subsequent event because it's expected. It's in line with what they were thinking or what they were processing about the event. In contrast, if they see two people who speak the same language and then express some sort of negativity or hostility towards one another, babies find that a little bit jarring and they look for a little bit longer.
And also the baby seemed surprised when people who spoke different languages were friendly with each other.
That's right. So you can also show babies the opposite. So babies can see two people who speak in two different languages, and then they seem to be somewhat surprised when they see that the two people are friends as opposed to disengaging. So there seems to be some sort of a rudimentary expectation among babies that two people who speak the same language are going to engage positively, and babies don't seem to have that expectation of two people who speak in two different languages. Now, I'll just add one caveat to this, that these were all monolingual English-hearing babies that we tested, and so I actually don't know what would happen if we tested a group of bilingual babies.
And that's an important distinction, but still, that result gave me pause because it almost seems to argue as if there is a built-in us versus them mentality in people that isn't entirely socially constructed. Is that true?
I think a lot of that is built in. But I also think when we think about the deep prejudice and divisions that we see as adults, that that's slightly different. And so in terms of what I think of as built in, I think the ability to form categories is absolutely built in, and categories of people. And so often that is going to involve some sort of an us versus them thinking. But what society provides is, something that's much stronger than this. It's about giving different categories of people different amounts of status, different amounts of societal value. And that's where you start to see really nefarious and deep prejudices that start to develop.
Right. And so talking about prejudices, I mean, one of the things in your book, it's not as if it didn't come as a surprise to me, but, you know, still certain things were surprising about it. And that is the degree to which people discriminate against those who have different accents, not just necessarily foreign accents. I mean, I'm even thinking, for example, you know, I remember reading an article about the fact that Bernie Sanders has a working class Jewish New York accent was part of why he was scorned by elites. I mean, I think that's kind of oversimplifying it. There were many other reasons they probably scorned him because of his point of view, but nonetheless, that played a role. So talk about accents and the construction of social categories that are discriminatory.
Yeah, so for any one person or any one interaction, it's always really hard to know if a bias occurred, right? You know, was this discriminatory? Was this someone didn't like this one individual having nothing to do with their social category? But there's lots of evidence showing that discrimination does occur at a group level. And so what I mean by that is that, you could have a bunch of participants interact with people and say they're interacting with someone who's speaking in a way that people consider to be standard versus speaking in a way that people consider to be non-standard or to be foreign. And then you find that people are treated really differently, that the kinds of inferences we make about people often reflect some cultural thinking about their group, some sort of societal attitude, as opposed to anything that's actually about the individual that they're interacting with.
Yeah, and you give the example of a Philippine man who grew up speaking English and must have also spoken, you know, perhaps Tagalog or another language, and a court case that, went against him. Tell us that story.
So this was the story of a Filipino-American man who was named Manuel Fragante, and it was in the early 1980s, and he was looking for a job. Now, he was an Army veteran living in Hawaii, and he really wanted to work for the Department of Motor Vehicles. Now, he took an entrance exam. It was a written exam, and he scored the highest on the exam. I think it was out of maybe hundreds of people who took it at the same day. And then he was given an interview for the job, and he wasn't given the job. And they said things, about his accent, saying, well, he has a Filipino accent and he can't, so he might not be clear at the DMV and it's a high stakes environment. And so they didn't give him the job. Now, a few things to note about this. Now, he filed a court case and he ultimately lost, which is why I think this is a really important story to think about. Now, he'd spoken in English for his, much of his career in different industries. He'd gone to college in English. And so he had a lot of experience communicating in English. Likewise, during his court proceeding, nobody had any trouble understanding him. His grammar was perfect and so forth. And so there was all this actual evidence of his real ability to communicate entirely effectively in English. And yet people had this sense that maybe he wasn't a good communicator, or maybe people would have trouble understanding him. And because of that, they didn't hire him. And I think this really highlights the important difference between objective and subjective communication and how this is something that we need to do better to protect against in the law. And so people can sometimes have a sense of someone being a poor communicator, saying, well, I just don't like his accent, I don't like the way he sounds, and then think that that means he's not a good communicator, when in fact, he could be communicating just fine and completely effectively. And so I think we need to do better at thinking about communication and employment discrimination.
Yeah, and in fact, he lost, you know, the cases. Did he go to the Supreme Court even? I mean, the judgment came down that denying him employment on the basis of accent was not discriminatory.
Mm-hmm. So the employment law, it's complicated. So it sometimes protects for discrimination against accent. So insofar as accent is seen as a proxy for national origin discrimination. So for instance, if you could say, look, this discrimination is because he's a Filipino American, that could be something that's considered as national origin discrimination. But the difference here is that they were saying it wasn't about his national origin. It was just about his accent, and it was just about his communication abilities. And so that's where the law starts to get really murky, and people don't think about the idea that communication is so subjective and often so prone to social bias.
And do you think there would have been the same result if he had spoken in an upper-class British accent?
I don't think so. And I think that's so important to keep in mind. And so, you know, when you can see cases in the law, you can see cases in educational settings where children are perhaps led to feel that the dialect they speak at home isn't as valued or isn't as good. And I like the idea of plugging in your mind, a child who speaks in a British accent at home. And I think you would just not encounter the same prejudices at all.
At least not in the U.S. And you point out also, you know, the Trayvon Martin case. Trayvon Martin was killed just before he was killed. He was talking to a friend of his. He was speaking with a friend, you know, talking about George Zimmerman and how creepy, you know, this guy was following him. And when George Zimmerman went on trial, Trayvon Martin's friend's testimony was completely overlooked.
Yeah.
Why was that?
That's right. So this was Rachel Jontel, and she spoke in a dialect of African-American English, which is a dialect of English, a legitimate dialect with an internal grammatical consistency. But oftentimes people have a lot of stigma against speaking in African-American English. And so she was completely, her testimony was overlooked, as you say. You know, she gave what she should have been the star witness, and reports from jurors afterwards said that they didn't even consider her testimony during the deliberations.
And why was that?
And the linguists who study this say this is because her dialect was less familiar. So in some senses, you know, anything that's less familiar might be harder to understand, but it's not just about understanding. It's not just about miscomprehension. It's also about stigmatizing stereotypes and people, you know, thinking that she's not as smart or not as good or not as credible because of the way she spoke, which is completely unfair and not just.
If you're just joining Writer's Voice, we're talking with psychologist Catherine Kinsler about her book, How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You. So, Catherine Kinsler, I'd like to shift a little bit now to talk about language and multi-language, bilingual. You're speaking with someone who, let's see, my first language was both English and Spanish because I moved to Mexico when I was 9 months old. And while my parents spoke to me in English, and actually my father had a very strong Dutch accent because he was Dutch, I was brought up also by a woman who was hired by my parents to take care of me, and she was Mexican and spoke to me in Spanish exclusively. So I was completely bilingual when I was a little kid. But when I came to the U.S. at the age of 4, I insisted on never speaking Spanish and thereby lost it because I felt quite rejected by the other kids in preschool. So talk a little bit about language and bilingualism, you know, the pros and cons of, frankly, I think they're mostly pros of bilingualism, but a lot of people think there are a lot of cons about having kids speak two languages.
Yeah, so I mean, I definitely fall on the pro side. Some of my, you know, of course, there's the advantages of learning multiple languages, right? So that might come with it possibilities of talking to different people, traveling to different places, having increased employment opportunities. So all of that, you know, is pretty clear. But as for the non-linguistic benefits, some of my research and other colleagues shows that when children are raised in a multilingual environment, even if they don't become proficient bilinguals themselves, they still might get some additional practice in perspective taking and thinking about, you know, different people's linguistic perspectives, who speaks what to whom, who understands what content, you know, we speak this way at home, we speak this way at school, and so forth. And so perspective taking is a critical part of interpersonal understanding and communication more generally. And so kids can become better at taking other people's perspectives, which I think is really important. Now, as for your question about, you know, what happened when a child say, you know, you're living in the US and you only want to speak English with your peers, that's actually very typical. And many parents of bilingual kids in the US report that. So for instance, you know, parents can keep speaking in Spanish or, you know, whatever the language is that they're speaking at home, and kids just start responding to them in English. And it actually makes a lot of sense from the perspective of language as a tool for social communication. That first of all, you know, I'm guessing if you were just wanting to speak in English, probably the people around you understood English. And so, you know, kids are pretty good at knowing like, well, I could speak in Spanish, but my English is communicating just fine. And then the second thing is that often kids want to speak the language of their peers. They want to fit in. And that's just such a, you know, a normal instinct for kids to have. And so I think for many parents who are trying to maintain a heritage language at home, the important thing to remember is that this is completely normal, that your kid is picking it up, even if they're not producing it, if they're just comprehending it, and that, you know, once they're in a social environment where speaking the language is required for communication and for social life, kids will do it. So I think just keeping it up and knowing that there can be benefits, even if children aren't actively speaking it themselves, but they're just immersed in a multilingual environment, I think that can be helpful to remember.
I also had the experience, I mean, I didn't speak Spanish for many, many years. And then when I was in my 20s, early 20s, I went to Spanish-speaking countries. And I picked it up so fast. And it seemed to me as if it was somewhere in there. Is that right? There's something you don't lose?
It's hard to find perfect studies of this, but there is some evidence of, you know, what people call savings, that you've just got a little bit, you know, that's still there underneath the surface, even if you don't speak it. And it might be just a little bit easier to master the second time around. And I think that's wonderful that that's what happened.
It also seemed like it was easier for me to master other languages. And I wondered if, you know, if you're bilingual to begin with, does that mean that you're going to have an easier time learning even languages later on? Because, you know, of course, it's much more difficult to learn a language later on.
It is more difficult to learn a language later on, and that's true for everybody. But I do think, you know, both knowing multiple languages, but also just being really open-minded and valuing multiple languages, that I think that can be something that's really helpful. And so, you know, adults aren't going to likely be able to learn a new language and master it to the level that a young child would, but they can still learn languages. And I think it's important for adults to remember that in many ways, it's not too late.
And another thing that was really fascinating, and I recognized in myself as well, is that speaking different languages makes you feel differently about yourself. In other words, when I speak Spanish, I feel like a slightly different person than I do when I speak English. And I remember studying Russian when I was in college, you know, a million years ago, and feeling very different when I spoke Russian. So I talk about what the connection between language and personality, I guess.
psychologists find similar findings with psychology studies. And so, you know, the way that you learn the language and the context you were in and the culture you were in, all of that can be wrapped up in your feelings of identity when you're speaking one language or another. So some researchers have found that people's memories are actually slightly different in two different languages, that when you're asked to bring up some autobiographical memories, the kind of memories that are kind of those that make you feel like you're you, that those can be a little bit different in one language or another. People also sometimes report that their gestures might be different, that the way they carry themselves, the way they make eye contact, all these kinds of cultural variables that can differ in different cultures and in different linguistic communities. When you're speaking one language or another, they can bring out different sides of you. The final thing to think about is that some researchers find that languages learned early in life may feel a little bit more emotional. And so, you know, when you're making decisions in one language or another, if it's a language that you learned when you were young, often things just strike you a little bit more emotionally. And so, you know, one example is hearing curse words in a native language versus a language learned slightly later on. And people often just find the curse words a little bit worse or more jarring in a native tongue.
And yet I even think that there's something about language itself, that different languages construct, almost create a different framework in the mind, a different way of thinking. So is there any research that points to that? That's just a feeling I have, so I'm not sure what the cause is.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty debated in psychology. And so how much are you going to really think differently in different languages? And I would say that's definitely something that's debated, with some researchers saying, well, you're going to think slightly differently depending on the way that the words are constructed, the way that the grammar is constructed. Whereas other people might say that, you know, pretty much all of human thought can be expressed in any language, just using slightly different words or constructions.
So when should kids, well, first of all, do you think kids should learn second languages in schools, something that really seems to be falling by the wayside? And when should they start learning a second language? Because it seems like mostly they're just offered in high school.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I really hope we can change. So of course it's wonderful if kids can get exposed to multiple languages from early in life, from infancy, but not all families have the possibility of doing that, right? So if everyone in your family speaks one language, and you don't have a caregiver or grandparent or somebody around to speak a different language, it's really hard for families to think about how would you reasonably expose your kid to multiple languages. Now, something miraculous happens, of course, which is that they start to go to school. And in school, it's such a natural place to introduce language learning. And what's really sad about language learning in this country, in the US, is that, as you said, many school districts, I mean, some school districts don't offer foreign languages at all, but if they do, often it's later on in middle school or high school. Whereas elementary school is when the best time to learn a foreign language is. And I think that often we think of language learning as kind of an extra, as, you know, not the main purpose of education, but an extra nice thing to be layered on top. And I think it should be seen as one of the main fundamental things that we teach kids.
Hear, hear. I completely agree with you. And there's so much more in this book, How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You. It's just been really delightful to talk with you, Catherine Kinsler, about this book.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. It was wonderful to hear your perspective.
Catherine Kinsler. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to her article about how bias against African American English speakers is a pillar of systemic racism. Next up, we remember David Graeber. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. and find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon or on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. It really helps other listeners find our show. When David Graeber died September 2nd, our schedule did not permit us at that time to replay our 2011 interview with him. But now it does. Graeber was an anthropologist, an anarchist activist who was involved in the planning of Occupy Wall Street, and the author of several major books, the most famous of which is Debt, The First 5,000 Years. We spoke with him in July of 2011, just weeks before Occupy Wall Street exploded at Zuccotti Park in downtown Manhattan, and then spread throughout the nation and the world. At a time when the Republicans, after exploding the national debt with their tax cut for billionaires, are making noises about the need to rein in the debt by slashing or ending Social Security and Medicare, we thought it would be a good time to re-air some excerpts from that interview. Debt, you say, is not an economic statement, but a moral statement. So you connect debt and morality, and I found that a fascinating kind of core point.
Yeah, one of the most disturbing things I really discovered when writing this has been the degree to which debt, morality, and violence have sort of been entwined throughout world history. If you look at the argument about the deficit and the debt today, it's very clear it has almost nothing to do with economics. It's a purely moral argument. You say, well, we need to get our house in order, households need to balance their budgets. It's a kind of language that strikes an immediate moral chord in people. So the fact that it makes no economic sense whatsoever, I mean, almost any economist who isn't explicitly paid to say otherwise will tell you this is silly. It doesn't really matter. And this has been the case for a very, very long period of time. One way I thought of summing it up is that debt is the most effective language ever come up with, the most effective system anyone's ever come up with to take a situation of profound structural inequality, basically violent inequalities, and to make it seem like the victim is at fault.
Violent inequalities, yet you also make the point that debt presupposes inequality between people.
Indeed, that's the great paradox. And when you talk about violent inequalities, I mean this often quite literally. Like people who militarily conquer other people will almost invariably try to come up with some formula to say that you owe us something, if only for not killing you, for example. I give the example of colonialism, where when the French conquered Madagascar, the first thing they did was say, well, you know, conquering people is very expensive. We need to be reimbursed for the cost of the army. We need to impose this tax. But they called it the moralizing tax, because it's supposed to teach people the value of work. This has occurred over and over and over again. And the problem that it creates is that if somebody says, like, you owe me something, there's almost no way to make a moral response against that that doesn't take the form of, now, wait a minute, who owes what to whom? And as soon as you do that, you're using the language of debt, that morality and debt are basically the same thing. So what you see over the course of world history is people sort of forced to use the language of debt to discuss moral problems when ultimately they know that it's not quite appropriate. Then there's the equality thing. And that's the sort of worm in the bud from the perspective of the powerful. Because while on the one hand, the language of debt is incredibly effective at making people feel they are to blame for problems that are imposed on them, often by just brute force, it has that implication of equality, which somewhat undermines the relationship. And thus, it tends to explode. One thing I've noticed is that most revolts, insurrections, and revolutions in world history focus on debt much more often than they focus on simple, explicit inequality. If you say you are slaves, you are serfs, you are untouchables, people will not be happy about that, and sometimes it will revolt. But they're much, much more likely to revolt if you say you're in our debt, because saying you're in our debt implies that there is a possibility of equality. It's very different than saying there's a pure relation of hierarchy. I am a superior type of person, you are inferior. Instead, you say, well, we should be equals, but you can't pay your debts.
It's interesting that you say this because, you know, when we saw the recent crisis, when the meltdown, the mortgage meltdown happened, you began to have people walking away from their debt. People whose houses were underwater were walking away, and they, it seemed that many of them, to the chagrin of commentators, seemed to feel that it was okay, that it was morally okay for them to walk away from their debt. I wonder if you could comment on that, and where do you think they got that idea that it might have been okay to walk away from their debt?
Well, I think that it's quite simple. That they just saw the rich people do it. I mean, AIG, how many billions did they owe? That's the insurance agency that backstopped all the sort of toxic assets that all the other banks had. And, you know, when they came up with these mortgage deals where they would give mortgages calculated to make the person default, then take bets on how long it would take them to default, package them together, and sell them to people. AIG were the people who actually backed up the bets. They knew that they were going to go belly up. There's no way they could possibly pay that. But all their debts were made to disappear. And much more than the $800 billion in bailout, the Federal Reserve was doing all sorts of really complicated things that made literally trillions of dollars of debt vanish. And I think this is a key moment on a level that people haven't really come to terms with. Because for years and years, we were told, well, markets, they run themselves. Debts have to be honored in order for markets to work. The need to pay one's debt was treated as the sacred responsibility. Now, of course, people running the system never really believed any of that. They knew better, but that was the line. And in 2008, it just became impossible to maintain. It became obvious that markets can't run themselves, that there's really people behind the scenes arranging everything, and that the big players do get bailed out. And even more, what they discovered was that debts can be made to vanish. Money is really a social arrangement. It's a series of promises and IOUs. So it doesn't correspond to anything real. And the people running the system know that, you know, any kind of promise can be renegotiated if there's a problem. However, they tried to maintain the idea that debt is still sacred for you. Well, obviously, no one was going to take that seriously anymore when they saw that those rules don't apply to the big guys.
Yeah, and in fact, this idea that debt can be renegotiated is, according to your book, Debt, is a very ancient idea, one that, in fact, the state constantly renegotiated debts all along, and we seem to have forgotten that. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the Jubilee year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Jubilee year is adopted from an old Mesopotamian practice, which is apparently about as old as interest-bearing loans themselves, which is that ancient Mesopotamia was often the case that every king, the first thing that they would do when they became king in the New Year's festival, they would declare a clean slate. All debts would be wiped out. Sometimes certain commercial loans were exempted, but consumer loans were systematically wiped out. One fascinating tidbit that I discovered was that the Sumerian word amargi, which is the first recorded word for freedom in any human language, actually refers to debt freedom, and literally it means return to mother. And the reason for that is because what would happen is people would fall into debt, and their things would be repossessed. They'd lose their vineyards. They'd lose their sheep. There's all these passages in the Bible about similar phenomena. But they'd also lose members of their family. People would take away children as debt peons, sometimes their wives. Amargi. Amargi, the Sumerian, the first recorded word for freedom, as I was saying, is really a word for debt freedom. What would happen is people would fall into arrears, into debt traps. They'd lose their lands, their animals, sheep, goats. Eventually, members of their family would be taken away as debt peons. In fact, it seems quite plausible that even the passage in the Bible about not coveting your neighbor's wife doesn't refer to lust in one's heart. In fact, adultery is already covered by a different commandment. It says, don't covet your neighbor's wife or donkey or servant. What it means is people who would be taken away if you make them alone. So it's really taking away your neighbor's wife to be your servant, to wash your laundry. Now, what would happen, therefore, is that when they declared debt freedom, everybody got to go home. So that it was literally all these people got to return to mother.
Now, you also say that debt and money are so intimately related that, in fact, am I right on this, that they came into being simultaneously?
Yeah, according to many interpretations, debt and money are the same thing. And it's quite obvious with modern paper money, which is a promissory note. I have a 10-pound note in my wallet that I still have from when I was in London. It actually has a picture of the Queen, and it says on it, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of 10 pounds. That's what money is. It's modern money is actually government debt. And economists have argued for centuries over what is the sort of primary meaning of money. Is money a commodity, gold, silver, which is used to measure the value of and facilitate the exchange of other commodities? Or is money a system of account whereby you can compare the values of things and measure credits and debts? Now, it's both, and that's the confusing thing about money. One of the other really striking things I discovered over the course of researching this book is that this argument has been going on as long as there's been money. Money has always been sort of both. And in different periods of history, one or another aspect comes to the fore. So originally, money was basically a credit system. It took several thousand years after the invention of what can only be called money. I mean, people are using complicated compounded interest transactions, they're using expense accounts. Clearly, there is money, but it took 2,000 years after that before you actually have coinage.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author David Graeber about debt. What is it, and how has it defined human society? Graeber's book is Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So if debt is money, and debt is, modern debt is, as you say, state debt, mm-hmm. and if the state, i.e. through the Federal Reserve, can erase trillions of dollars worth of debt at whim, then why are we in such a conundrum over the debt that the U.S. has right now?
Well, debt is a series of political agreements, and the problem is the politicians are not in agreement over how the system should work. I think that there's a profound shift going on. We're coming out of a phase of where money was assumed to be a commodity, where the dominant view of money was that it actually was gold and silver. Even paper money was a promise to pay, specifically bullion. Now, in that transition, all the rules are clearly going to change, and on one level, people are still using this language where money is treated as a scarce resource, which is appropriate to another age. If money is just an IOU, it's a set of promises, it's a purely political phenomenon. Yet part of that political game is pretending it's something else. It's also true that because of the morality of debt, you can make this argument that makes sense to people, saying, well, there's only so much money. We need to be frugal. We need to pay our debts. And that's used in particular by the right as an excuse to do what they really want to do, which is to destroy any institutions which are based on a sense of communal mutual trust and mutual insurance, such as Social Security, Medicare, and so forth.
Well, here, now, it seems to me that you are now completing the circle in a way, because we started out this discussion talking about debt and morality. And one of the points that you make in your book, you have three principles of economics. And one of them is, you say, the very first one is the, what you call the communistic one, which is the, well, explain what that is, and then tell us why that's a fundament of morality.
The morality of debt, I argued, is based on a principle of exchange. Morality becomes a matter of paying your debts when you imagine that all transactions, I mean, all interactions that people have are essentially forms of exchange. And that's what economists basically argue. And to a large degree, almost all social theorists have ended up subscribing to some version of that. I mean, if they dislike the sort of economic version where everybody's trying to get the best deal possible for themselves, they can say, well, it's reciprocity, it's a moral equivalence, but it's still a logic of exchange. Now, one of the things that I really wanted to highlight in writing this, and this is the really anthropological part of the book, is that this isn't true. We're so obsessed with exchange, we fail to notice that much of our interactions on a day-to-day basis don't operate on anything like principles of exchange and reciprocity. If you think of reciprocity as simply tit for tat, I do something for you, you will either now or eventually do something equivalent for me. So that's why I started by talking about communism. Now, I know it's somewhat of a provocative term because we're used to thinking of communism in this very politicized, really rather mythological way. Once upon a time, there were these primitives and they all shared everything, and now we've fallen into a state of sin. Often it's very explicitly biblical. We have private property, we're all divided, but someday perhaps we shall get rid of property. I think communism has nothing to do with property rights. The original meaning of the term was supposed to be from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. That's a sort of classic definition. That's a logic of distribution. It has nothing to do with who owns something. And what I pointed out is that if you look at that logic, then, you know, just as a way of people interacting with one another, we do that all the time. If you're at work, you mostly behave communistically in that sense. If we're working for ExxonMobil or whatever corporation it might be, and there's a leak in a pipe and someone says, hey, hand me the wrench, you don't say, yeah, what do I get for that? Oh, people behave on the basis of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs while cooperating to solve a problem because it's the only thing that works, ironically. So my definition of communism has nothing to do with top-down systems of state control, which are basically military phenomena.
Or families or neighbors.
Families act that way. And to some degree, anybody who isn't overtly hostile to one another, there's an assumption of shared sociability on any level, there will be some minimal level of communism. So in a way, almost all other relations are built on a bedrock of communism. An example would be if the cost is small enough or the need is great enough. Example of the need great enough, I'm drowning. You know, anybody's going to throw me a life preserver. Cost small enough, can you give me a light? Directions.
And in fact, if you were to ask the person first before throwing them the life preserver, what are you going to give me in exchange, you would be seen as an immoral person.
Exactly, yes. I mean, there's some level on which, of course, we're all going to be communists. And what that level is varies according to the standards of sociability current in any given time or place. There are many places in the world where it's basically impossible to refuse a request for food. One example I love to use is there's this Maori story of this guy named Te Renga, and I don't know if it's really true, but it's like the sort of story people like to tell about this guy who, he never did much fishing himself, but he would just sort of walk along the beach when other people came back and say, wow, squid, I love squid, you got some squid? And like, yeah, okay, here. Have the squid. And he'd just do this over and over again, whatever they caught. He was like the best thing. He would say, oh man, it's my favorite. And there was just no way not to give it to him. So eventually people formed a war party, ambushed him and killed him. It's like easier to actually just smash the guy over the head than to say, no, I'm not going to give you the squid this time.
Right. Well, so in a way there is some implied reciprocity. Societies are built on the idea that cooperation, I mean, the very idea of cooperation means that you are going to do for others as they need it, and therefore they will do for you as you need it as well. It's just that it's not an accounting system.
Yes, it depends on how you define reciprocity. If you mean like balance on some level, yes. I mean, what I'm calling communism is based on an assumption of eternity. If you have a friend who you assume is always going to be your friend, you don't have to count who's done what for whom because you know if you need something, they will always be there. And society, in a similar way, there will always be people to give you directions. You don't have to worry if I'm ever going to get directions from this guy. Similarly, we treat people who we like to think of as that will always be there that way. That's why you don't have to keep account of your mother because your mother will always be there. You feel that way, even though, of course, you know it's not true.
So bringing this back to then Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, well, let's say Social Security and Medicare. Here are two programs, entitlements. Why are they entitlements? We pay into them. I mean, Social Security even has nothing to do with the debt because it's a self-paid system. And yet, it seems that the idea is that it's okay to violate the promises mm-hmm. that are implied in Social Security and Medicare. Each one of us is paid into the system in order to get it back out later, in order to bail out people who have created a debt crisis that we had nothing to do with.
Precisely. And this is one of the things that it's interesting. When I talk about the idea of debt cancellation, people seize on this. And the book is not a clarion call, we must cancel the debt. So at the very end, I throw out, maybe a jubilee wouldn't be a bad idea just to make people realize that these things are political and can be renegotiated. But people seize on that and like they said, but wait a minute, you can't forgive debts. I mean, who would lend money if they couldn't be sure they would get the money back? Well, aside from the fact that that flies in the face of basic economics where you're supposed to be taking a risk, leave that aside. Why does nobody ever make that argument politically? I mean, if a promise to a hedge fund is just a promise that has no different moral value than a promise to your constituents, why is it just assumed that, well, realism means we can't actually afford these things, so I have to break all my promises to my constituents? You know, reality just means I can't break my promise to bankers. But you can equally well make the argument, well, you know, if politicians constantly break their promises to constituents, well, people won't vote, and that will imperil democracy. Just like you could say, you know, if you break your promises to bankers, they won't lend, and that'll imperil the economy. But no, and in fact, that's exactly what's happened. Most people don't vote because they assume that politicians are liars who will always break their promises. No one even talks about that as a consideration. What does that say about us? You know, a country that prides itself on being a democracy, that's our most important thing in our self-identity. Yet it never even occurs to anybody to make that point.
We're talking with David Graeber about his book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. And talking about those 5,000 years, you make some fascinating connections between debt and the origin of some of the most basic human relationships. For example, I mean, we've already talked about a bit about debt and violence. Debt and the state, we've talked about some of that, but also the position of women, debt nice. And patriarchy.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. And some of that was inspired by my readings of some feminist historians like Gerda Lerner, but some of it really only occurred to me while I was in the process of writing, because we have this image of Babylon, sort of patriarchal religions have this image of Babylon as the sin city. It's like both the place of financiers and the place of prostitutes. And patriarchal imagery and sensibilities constantly comes back over and over again. In the Bible and even the Greek stories like Herodotus had this idea of Babylon as a land where everybody had to prostitute themselves at least once. And it goes all the way down to, you know, reggae music, and which is also actually, you know, Rastafari is very patriarchal. It's all about reasserting male authority. And I started looking into the origins. What I discovered was that it has a lot to do with the whole phenomena of debt peonage. So if you look at the very earliest Sumerian records, this is one of the great mysteries of history, sort of confounds a lot of our notions of progress, that the very earliest records we have from Mesopotamia, well, it's not like there's total equality between men and women, but there's a situation not that different than what might apply in America today. You know, there are a lot of women doctors. They're not 50-50, but there are. There's a lot of women administrators. You know, there's even some women rulers. And that all vanishes. You know, all this stuff about premarital virginity and, you know, sequestering people away was not present, not a consideration. And over the course of about 1,000 years, this changes dramatically. No one knows why. And the old theory was, well, it's the Semites. You know, there's these nice Sumerians. They believe in relative equality. And then there's the patriarchal people like those patriarchs in the Bible. And that's what patriarch originally referred to these guys out in the desert with their flocks and wives and daughters locked up. They gradually came in. And it's true, Semitic languages did gradually displace Sumerian. So maybe those guys messed up everything. However, if you look at the record, it's much more political than that, because the reason why they had to declare these debt moratoriums is because people would defect, essentially, and join these sort of semi-nomadic bands that lived outside the fringes of cultivation, outside the urban areas where basically their creditors couldn't get at them. If they're going to take away their sheep and their daughters, they just take their sheep and their daughters and they take off to the desert. And what was the greatest fear if you were a poor Sumerian or Mesopotamian is that your daughter was going to be taken away and, like, put to work as a prostitute, which in fact did happen to a lot of these debt peons. There's this fascinating shift where, you know, in a credit system, prostitution sort of centered on temples. And that happened because, of course, in a credit system, prostitution is rather a different thing. It's more like courtesans, people with an ongoing mistresses. But it gradually turns in with a creation of something more like a cash economy to this much more impersonal, unpleasant business. So that at first you have this apparently rather sexual rituals happening in temples where the women who were engaged in this were in fact the most cultured, cultivated, and sort of embodiment of civilization. But then these red light districts form around the temples where they're just bringing women and also boys who are just like taken away from their families for debt. It turns into the sort of every parent's nightmare. And so they take off. And so this like connection of like the land of high finance and the land of universal prostitution makes sense to these people. And the idea of sequestering your daughters away to protect them makes sense too. locking them up so that people can't remove them for possibly horrible types of work. And I think that has a lot to do with the sudden obsession with virginity, which just wasn't an issue before the creation of harems, but also the fact that people could be prostitutes, something Gerda Lerner pointed out, has a lot to do with phenomena like veils. The very first law we have about veils in the Middle East is a Middle Assyrian text, which actually says that, you know, respectable women have to go veiled in public. Prostitutes and slaves are not allowed to wear veils. And all the penalties are not on the women, you know, the nice girls who don't, but on the good girls who do.
On the bad girls.
I'm sorry, the bad girls who do. Yeah, so you have to know who the bad girls are. You shouldn't try to pass yourself off as respectable. And in fact, veiling is another thing I discovered. This is like talking about confounding all of our assumptions. Veiling was somewhat unevenly practiced in the Middle East and in the late Bronze Age, early Iron Age. One place it was fairly systematically practiced, apparently, was ancient Athens. Athenian women actually had to go out in veils. So it's like sort of, think of this as the land of rationality and freedom as the very opposite, and the Middle East with the veils is a symbol of the very opposite. But in fact, it was a continuation of the same thing as far as women lived there concerned.
So a woman who basically is unfree, who has no power over her own body, is the one who is unveiled.
Mm-hmm. She's sexually available for money. And women who are not sexually available for money, you know, that is, you can't see at all.
Our obscenely bloated military budget takes up the lion's share of our national spending and national debt. In another part of the interview David Graeber gave me in 2011, I asked him the following. What would happen if our dreams came true and we cut the military budget and instead the debt would go towards things like, repairing our degraded infrastructure and education and health and all that? I mean, would that mean that it actually couldn't function the same way? Would you have to rewire the whole international system?
We would. We'd have to rewire the international system and we would have to seriously change power relations. Relying on this essentially military model, which the U.S. has been doing certainly for the last 30, 40 years, arguably longer, you know, has the advantage of putting people with finance capital in an extraordinarily strong position. All of that would have to go. And all of that did start to go in 2008, the sort of magic world of finance, which was created around this military system, started crumbling. Nothing has actually been fixed. What they basically did is put a giant Band-Aid over the rubble, hoping that it won't collapse quite as quickly. But you know, what we see is a continual series of debt crises. 2008 isn't over. There's the sovereign debt crisis. There's the debt ceiling arguments. There's a million different forms in which it reappears and will continue to reappear until some sort of structural change happens. And I think one of the things that, ironically enough, you know, we have this president who ran on a platform of change. You know, what seems to be historically, he will be remembered as the person who was willing to make heroic, mighty efforts to change as little as possible when the world was radically shifting around him. And it seems like if there's any sort of common theme to everything he does, starting with 2008, when, you know, not nationalizing the banks, not changing the system was extraordinarily difficult, he figured out a way to do it, is that we have this person who's willing to do whatever it takes to try to not really change the system very much. But it can't work forever.
David Graeber, talking with Writer's Voice in 2011 about his book, Debt. He passed away from a heart attack September 2nd, 2020. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.